Lectures delivered at a spiritual retreat. Emperor Martyr John Cardinal McCloskey, Archbishop of New York, May 5th, 1885. Preface. At a retreat in a convent in the south of Ireland nearly 30 years ago, some lectures were delivered by a holy secular priest who spoke without notes or memoranda. When each was over, I wrote it out from memory. Though assured by the other listeners of the accuracy of the report, yet I may have omitted something the preacher said, or inserted something he did not say, or merely given all that an unusually retentive memory retained of discourses sufficiently striking in the delivery. Hence, the report cannot be considered verbatim. So many have applied for copies from time to time that, acting on the advice of the late Archbishop of New Orleans, I had them carefully read by a learned ecclesiastic with a view to their publication as the shortest method of placing them within reach of all who desire them. The few now living who were present with me on the occasion referred to will doubtless miss the touch of the varnished hand, and still more, the sound of the voice that is still. Yet the lectures, such as they are, may aid in the struggle toward the higher life, religious, and others who have leisure and the inclination to read them, especially in times of retreat. First lecture on the importance of a retreat. Dearly beloved sisters, the subject I propose for your consideration in this instruction is the great importance of the spiritual exercises you have just commenced and the use you should make of them. If you reflect a little, you will see that the grace of making a retreat is a special favor granted to you in preference to thousands of sinners who would probably be rescued from impending perdition if such a grace were given them. Were it in my power to place 100 of the greatest sinners in retirement and cause them to rise early and make such meditations as you will make, assist at Mass daily, make numerous considerations and examines, receive the sacraments, and fulfill all the various conditions a retreat requires, they would in all probability be thoroughly converted and saved from the dreadful eternal consequences of unrepented sin. God gives you this particular grace denied to so many. Not content with bestowing on you what is necessary for your salvation, he has called you from a world where sin holds sway and iniquity abounds. He has snatched you as a brand from the furnace and placed you in his own sanctuary. And as if this were not enough, he now summons you even from your ordinary duties, holy and perfect though they be, that you may reflect on the daily routine of your lives and find out whatever is defective in you. Numberless graces have been given you, good measure, pressed down, overflowing. See how you have acted on your side. Remember that in the spiritual exercises you are now making, you have a most efficacious means of correcting your defects and planting the germs of every virtue in your souls. But dearly beloved sisters, one might think that the sanctity of your calling, the holiness of your various avocations, the edifying example of the community would suffice to keep you free from sin and imperfection. Not necessarily. The angels sinned in heaven, and our first parents sinned in paradise. You are even in more danger of becoming accustomed to holy things than seculars, and from custom may spring to certain familiarity, which is one of the most dangerous feelings a religious can experience. If persons living in the world go to confession or to Mass, they may leave their own houses, and the contrast between their usual business and that which engages them when they perform any spiritual function is so great that even it inspires reverence. But religious are surrounded by things sacred. The very building in which they live is consecrated. Their habits are blessed before they put them on. Everything about them is invested with sanctity. Religious need not leave their houses to worship the incarnate Lamb, to assist at the tremendous sacrifice, to see their God into their hearts. For them, every duty is regulated with the exactness of the ceremonies of the Church. They daily move in an appointed orbit, wherein I may say they continually revolve about the Blessed Sacrament. By their contiguity to it, and to every other means of perfection, it is possible that their reverence may be lessened. When first God enlightened you on the vanity of this world, and gave you the blessed desire of consecrating yourselves irrevocably to His blessed service in this holy sisterhood, fear of God's justice, reverence for what is sacred, love for the divine goodness, and gratitude for God's mercies were the sentiments dominant in your minds. And if you still preserve these holy dispositions, it is because you have, by daily meditations and examines, by exactness to the smallest observance, by fidelity to grace, and by making a right use of retreats, counteracted the inherent corruption and inconstancy of your nature. Without this, in spite of rules, enclosure, save for performing the works of mercy, and even vows, you are not proof against the evil tendencies of fallen nature. The greatest saints felt this and prescribed occasional retreats as the best, if not the only, remedy. St. Charles Borromeo, St. Francis de Sales, St. Ignatius, and St. Alphonsus are all eloquent in recommending to clergy and religious the frequent and periodical use of the spiritual exercises to save them from the numberless perils to which they are exposed when they run on blindly towards eternity without considering their paths. We have a still higher example. Had no saint ever recommended or practiced retreat, we have the example of the Son of God, who before he began his public life fled to the desert for 40 days, which he dedicated to prayer and fasting. Not that he required to be strengthened or forewarned of approaching danger, but for our instruction and example, and to show us that the most holy and perfect cannot be dispensed from these exercises. You have now, dear sisters, flown to the wilderness. Separate yourselves, then, from all things. Go through these days of benediction with solitude of heart. Forget anxieties, troubles, attachments, studies, occupations, that you may be alone with God, alone. Say to him with the spouse in the canticles, "My beloved to me, and I to him." If you now fail to listen to his voice, it may never again sound in your ears. Beseech the Holy Ghost to show you in the clearest manner the real state of your soul, and prepare to render an account of your spiritual stewardship. I do not suppose that you have great sins to bewail. I trust by God's mercy that you have been forgiven the graver offenses committed in the ignorance or willfulness of youth. But looking back on the past since your last retreat, or since your entrance into religion, is there not much over which you have cause to shed bitter tears? Have you not faults to atone for, which might appear slight in seculars, but may have been weighty offenses in you? Has your intention always been upright before God? Have you never given way to disgust or disrelish for prayer and the sacraments? Have you never been, for ever so short a time, willfully distracted at prayer? Have you kept due guard over your senses? Have you given way to tepidity of heart or dissipation of mind? Has your obedience been prompt and accompanied with the dispositions which render obedience perfect? Has your charity towards your neighbor been all that God requires? Has your resistance to temptation been prompt and, as much as lies in you, effectual? See if some worm or canker has not been eating away the precious fruit of all your labors. if you are not like those apples of the east, which outwardly seem fair and lovely, but within are only ashes and corruption. Perhaps, while you are lauded within and without your convent, your hands are empty before God. See what the obstacles to your perfection are, and cast them from you. Remember the dread alternative. If thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out, and if thy right hand offend thee, cut it off. For it is better to go into heaven maimed than to have two eyes or two hands in hell. Besides reviewing your faults, you should examine what progress you have made in virtue. It is not enough that you avoid evil, you must also bear fruits of holiness. How long has the master of the vineyard been seeking fruits of justice in you? How long will you appear as the barren fig tree? In what spirit have you discharged your duties? Do you possess the virtue of humility, obedience, patience, desire of God's glory, essential to your state? Have you that sincere desire to mortify self-will, that resignation under crosses, that thorough detachment, without which you bear only the name and habit of religion? Do you cultivate that disengagement from all created things essential for those who have taken God alone for their portion? Have you that zeal for God's honor in your own and your neighbor's salvation required by the great precept of the new law? Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with thy whole heart, and thy neighbor as thyself for the sake of God. Are you satisfied you have done, I will not say what the saints have done, but what might reasonably be expected of you? Should you be content with yourselves, will you now call to render an account of your stewardship? The special end of this retreat is to correct whatever is defective on these points. And if you beg of God in the sincerity of your hearts to show you all that displeases him in you, he will make known to you why so many good works, prayers, recitings of the office, meditations, examines, works of mercy, spiritual and corporal, have been almost fruitless. Every one of these should be a link of gold to bind you to God and make you ascend the mysterious ladder which reaches from earth to heaven. What reason have you not for shame and confusion in God's presence? What bitter tears should you not shed for such abuse of time and grace? Pour out your whole hearts before him. Apply your mind to rectify the disorders of the past, and God will shed upon you the purifying waters of his mercy, even the living waters of which he is the fountain. And your soul, now a useless desert, will blossom like the rose. The mere performance of the exercises will not suffice. You might pass these days in a very edifying manner and go through the appointed holy duties and not gain the true objects of retreat. The pious practices of this periodical solitude, though good in themselves, are only means to obtain the great object of your lives, the eradication of faults and the planting of virtues in your soul. Apply in good earnest to this. Let it be the point of all your prayers, meditations, and solitary communings with self. Remember, you must strive to uproot evil tendencies, not merely in part, but utterly and irrevocably. The more searching and practical your examines are, the more useful and effectual they will be. See if you have not begun these holy exercises without relish, through mere custom, to avoid singularity, or with dissatisfaction at being removed for some days from occupations to which you feel attached. Lay open your hearts before God. Ask pardon for receiving so great a grace with imperfect dispositions. This may be your last retreat. This has been said to you before and has not come true, but it is nearer the truth now than it was ever before. In any case, do you act as though you were certain a similar favor should never more be accorded you? That is the best way to profit by present grace. Listen, then, to the voice of God calling you to solitude. I will allure her, I will lead her into the wilderness and speak to her heart. Reply with the prophet, My heart is ready, O God, my heart is ready. Who will give me wings as a dove, that I may flee from created things and rest in thy bosom? Cleave now to him with such affections that you may be able to say with the great apostle, Who then shall separate me from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation, or distress, or famine, persecution, or the sword? For I am sure that neither life, nor death, nor any creature whatsoever shall separate me from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus. If you do your part, God will not fail to do his. But remember, the removal of one evil tendency, particularly a predominant one, or the weakening of it, will profit you more than the most rapturous contemplations on the sublimest mysteries. There may be delusion in contemplation, but there can be none in rooting out bad habits and planting virtues in the soul. Second Lecture on Eternity. A traveler setting out on a journey should know the way to take, the objects of his travels, and the length of time they may consume. All his efforts must be directed to this one object, how he may attain a happy termination of what he has in view. So when we begin a spiritual life or spiritual exercises, we must direct our thoughts to the end of life's journey, eternity. Towards that one point, we are all moving. Those who went before us have arrived there, those who are with us are journeying onward, and those who will come after us must follow us thither. We can describe and form an idea of many things, but eternity is not susceptible to description. It is infinite. The earth, the heavens, air, ocean, and even space itself to a certain extent have been measured by scientific men. But eternity is incapable of measurement. It is illimitable. We can discern proportions, properties, and magnitude in most things. We know if we take away a part of anything, that which remains is less than the whole. But eternity, according to our ideas, can never be increased nor diminished. It is immutable, immeasurable, incomprehensible, likened to God. A shoreless ocean, always moving and ever at rest. Phantomless as an abyss, and exhaustless as God's perfections. The widest main ever explored by the adventurous mariner. The broadest lands conquered by the heroes of old. The farthest limits visible to the mental eye of science. Beyond the most distant star, beyond space itself. These things we may, perhaps, imagine, but eternity we cannot grasp. Always, never. Always existing, no ending. Were creation and this world to be continued for millions of ages, all would not be as a drop of water to the ocean when compared to eternity. We cannot realize the unending. It is too much for us. Everything around us changes. Scarcely can we fancy what stability is. Here below, everything has ended or shall end. Dynasties founded, to use a scriptural expression, on the eternal hills, the longest race of kings, the omnipotent empires of antiquity, the Assyrian, the Persian, the Roman, all have long since come to an end. The things which interest people in our own days will soon have vanished. Nay, the great and magnificent cities of Europe will one day have an end. Their ruins will be visited by the antiquarians of inner countenance, when their names and splendor will be no more than those of Babylon and Nineveh at present. Even the stream of knowledge and civilization which rolls over the earth will meet its period and come to an end. But eternity will never terminate. It is a mass, a labyrinth, which cannot be explored even in thought. Wherever I am placed at the moment of death, there is my situation forever. If hell be awarded me, I must remain there forever. If heaven be my portion, whether instantaneously or through the purifying flames of purgatory, heaven forever. Where the tree falls, to the north or to the south, there it shall remain. My doom once is my doom forever. And believing this with Christian faith, would you not say that anyone who runs the least risk of consigning himself to eternal torments was mad? You believe that one mortal sin deserves an eternity of woe. Now, is it not worse than madness to put yourself in the smallest danger of incurring that awful penalty? Have you ever done so? Have you even added sin to sin, tempting God, abusing His clemency, and playing with the most awful of His attributes, His tremendous justice? Like children on the brink of a precipice, in danger of being dashed to pieces every instant. And had God's justice then grasped you, your soul would not indeed be broken to pieces, but you would live on to endure His terrible vengeance forever. Eternity knows no change. If there were some variety, His torments would not be so insupportable. Everything here changes. The varied and beautiful phenomenon of nature, all imperfect though it be, the seasons preparing us one for the other, spring gliding into summer, summer fading into autumn, the frost of winter followed again by the genial, freshening breezes of spring. The sun rising and setting, the moon growing and waning. Everything perpetually changing. The material world altering its appearance, the social changing its fashions, the political laying aside old opinions to adopt new ones, and meanwhile, all who play any part, mean or dignified, in the drama of life, passing slowly perhaps, but surely, to the eternal home. If the tree fall to the north or to the south, there it shall remain. You shall go into the house of your eternity, and thereafter know no more vicissitude. Your friends and relatives, like those who went before them, will transact their business, arrange their affairs, labor here a while, and then die. No other change for them. The time of probation will have passed forever. Nothing is continuous here. Even a galley slave has intervals of rest. His hard toil is broken. He must eat and sleep. A patient finds periods of calm on his fevered bed. Sleep and unconsciousness shorten time for him. And in his greatest pains, he can at least comfort himself by the reflection that they cannot last forever. No suffering can endure long in this world. But in hell, there is no change, no hope, no death, no annihilation, which would be the greatest boon. Never can we illustrate eternity. We have no image for it. The Holy Fathers have tried to give us some faint idea of it by negative comparisons. Thus, were an immense globe swelled out beyond the remotest limits which the keen eye of science can picture, filled with grains of sand, and should an angel remove one atom every 1,000 or 10,000 years, the period of time, if time it could be called, would arrive when not a grain would remain. Or to use the comparison of St. Bonaventure, Suppose a damned soul were to shed one tear every 1,000 years, and at that rate enough to fill first a small vial, then a lake, a river, a sea, finally enough to inundate this globe, cover the highest mountains, and pass beyond the limits of imaginable space. But calculations of this kind overwhelm the mind. We cannot support them. We cannot enter into them. And were we to find in metaphorical language illustrations still more expressive, all will fall immensely short of giving us the faintest idea of the magnitude of eternity. Yet we know that an eternity of woe awaits us if we die in mortal sin. What then ought we not do to avoid it? No matter what is to be gained or who is to be pleased, surely we should never be mad enough to risk, even an idea, this hopeless misery. We ought to feel that no sacrifice is too great, that we must not even think of sparing ourselves when there is question of avoiding eternal ruin. But you may be tempted to think that the pains of eternity, however great, must become slight when scattered over such an immensity. Not so. Every moment presses on the sufferer with the full weight and consciousness of eternity. A sphere, from the nature of its form, as considered by scientific men, cannot rest on a plane surface with more than one point at a time. If rolled one way or another, some new point comes in contact with the planes over which it moves or rests, and each particular point bears the whole weight of it. Even so, every moment in hell sustains the pressure of an eternity. But never can we fathom this great mystery. The mind becomes oppressed, the head aches, the heart sickens at the bare idea of it. And if the mere consideration of it weary, unutterable length overwhelms the brain. What must that awful reality be which the brightest genius in religion or science shrinks from attempting to fathom? The least pain here would become unendurable were we assured it would last forever. A headache or toothache, indefinitely prolonged, would become insupportable. We cannot bear anything lasting, whether pain or pleasure. The most entrancing music soon loses its charms. The most fascinating scenes cease to delight us when we are compelled to gaze on them for a lengthened period. Were you laid on a bed of roses and all the delicious perfumes of southern climes waft around you? Your happiness would change into misery were you assured you should forever remain thereon. If this be true of earth's joys, what shall I say of its sorrows? If you cannot bear to have transitory delights indefinitely prolonged, how would it be if you were chained down in hell, plunged in a pool of fire, with eternity written before you in characters of flame? How will you feel when ages shall have passed away, and you look back on that for which you bartered happiness, your friends and relatives, lost or saved, and the very world in which you lived, your little day burned up? A city in the distance looks like a village. Worlds hanging in space around us appear but as sparks. What estimate will you form of the feelings which agitated you, the passions which disturbed you, the pleasures for which you forfeited heaven? Ah, these you will hardly remember. You will be alive only to your unutterable woe. What do you now remember of your childhood, save the more important events, which were, so to speak, the hinges on which your destiny turned? And the memory of these is daily fading away. The greater part of the past has become obscure or invisible to you. What, then, will be your ideas of those things when you behold them from the dim regions of unchangeable eternity? To me, these reflections are so awful, so appalling, that I cannot conceive how an atheist who believes in the mere possibility of a God can risk the loss of his soul. for even an atheist ought to be a saint, or at least do the works of a saint, so long as there is the remotest possibility of his being answerable for his thoughts, words, and deeds in eternity. Now, if this be true of one who denies the existence of God and regards it as a mere possibility, what should be our feelings? We who believe with an undoubtable faith that if we die in mortal sin, we shall be tormented in hell, not for 10 or 20 or 1,000 years, but forever and ever. If the tree fall to the north or to the south, there it shall lie. The conclusion to be drawn from this awful truth is that you should despise this world, its pleasures, affections, applause, and contempt. You should particularly make all things subordinate to eternity. Refer all your actions to it, and detach yourself from anything which ever so little draws you from your end. Thank God, who has made you sensible to this great truth, and if, by want of vigilance over self, or reflection on the awful fate which awaits you, should you wander from the end of your creation, you have fallen into negligence or indifference, oh, repair the past. Think what a terrible doom to be cast off from God forever. The very wounds of Jesus only means of driving you further into perdition. No hope, no prayer, no advocate. Think of the horror, the woe, the irreparable misfortune of the lost. Heaven or hell awaits you. It is in your power to choose either. All depends on your compliance with your obligations. All is in your own hands. All hangs on your own exertions. Pray earnestly that God may show you the obstacles to your perfection. Ask the Mother of God and all his saints and angels to intercede for you, that he may not cast you off forever. May he in whose power are all things delivered us from the eternal torments of that yawning gulf. May he receive us all into his kingdom and crown us with the glories of a blissful eternity. Amen. The third lecture on death. Eternity naturally suggests the thought of death, for our eternity depends on our death. For most persons, death is an unpleasant subject. But as physicians often prescribe violent and painful remedies for invertebrate diseases, we should neutralize our worldliness by the thought of death. You know, on divine authority, the awful consequences of being caught up by death unawares, and reason and experience suggest the necessity of doing all we can to prevent so dreadful a catastrophe. Sin and death enter the world with us, and it is only by placing one against the other that we can conquer our evil inclinations. Hence that sentence of the Holy Ghost, which you have so often heard and pondered. In all thy works remember thy last end, and thou shalt never sin. The thought of death is an antidote to every evil. Worldlings fly from it. For did they remember their last end, they would soon cease to revel in their excesses. This thought is well calculated to inspire dread. The wicked shrink from it as an unpleasant interruption of their mad career, and even those who have served God from childhood and made noble and generous sacrifices for him, even you, who have renounced all you possess to serve him more perfectly, you, consecrated religious, look with awe on that moment upon which hangs your eternal destiny. It is appointed unto all men once to die. Oh, how frequently should we reflect on the sad but solitary lesson given to our first parents. Dust thou art, and into dust thou shalt return. The first great lesson we should draw from the certainty of death and the dread uncertainty of the time and manner of its approach is the need of incessant vigilance over ourselves, that whenever it comes, it may not find us unprepared. Our tenor of life is so uncertain, it is not right to call it tenor at all. For we have no hold on a single hour or moment of it, that we should always be ready for death. It is not always the oldest and the weakest who go first, or the sickly and miserable. Youth is no security, health no guarantee, beauty no protection. You know of many sudden deaths among your friends, relations, and acquaintances. The daily journals teem with records of sudden deaths, some struck down at their own board in the midst of a beloved family, some on a journey, some have slept never to wake again, some have fallen dead in the streets, some in the solitude of their chambers. In these and other ways have men and women been hurried before the tribunal of an omnipotent judge without time to call on him for mercy. If you had two souls, it would not be wonderful if you failed to take care of the first, seeing that you might gain experience by experimenting on that and saved the second. But you have only one soul, one chance, one opportunity. What madness to risk that one soul. No one is exempt from death. Bishops, priests, solitaries, all must go. No one may refuse to answer death's summons. The seclusion and tranquility of your convent home may exempt you from many of the causes of death, but your turn must come, and you know not the day nor the hour. When, where, or how is unknown, save to one, Almighty God. Whether your death be sudden or your last illness protracted, all is shrouded in uncertainty. But you do know that at no very distant period, you will be laid upon that bed from which you will never get up alive. And it will be said of you, as you have said of others, she is dead. Your convent will be a house of mourning. Some will weep for you, and this will say, Sister is dead, may the Lord have mercy on her. And others again may say, Well, who would have thought of her so near her end? Who would have guessed it this time yesterday? It is not that I fear lest any of you be in mortal sin that I thus address you. God has doubtless preserved you from so dire a misfortune. It is that death may not find you slumbering at your post in lukewarmness or negligence, that you may always watch, that your souls may abound in every virtue, that your hands may be filled with good works and your days full and perfect before God, so far as zeal for his glory and practical usefulness are concerned. The second lesson to be drawn from the consideration of death is that of universal, unrepining detachment. The vows require this, for they strip you of earthly goods not merely in spirit but in reality. Therefore, should you acquire the total detachment from created things which your state requires, whatever you know or do not know about your approaching dissolution, this you are certain of. That even of a few things allotted to your use, you could take nothing away, nothing but the habit it is your blessed privilege to wear. Is it not terrifying to think that of all your friends, of all your love and esteem, not one can you take out of this world with you? You must go alone with your good and evil deeds. Death will come when least expected, and you and I must respond to its summons and go alone before God alone. The mightiest monarch that treads the earth with thousands of brave men ready to face death at his pleasure or his bidding must go alone. Not one of his multitudinous troops can cross death's perils with him. The richest merchant that traffics in earthly goods cannot take with him a single farthing. The king and the peasant, the rich and the poor, the noble and the plebeian, all learned and the ignorant, All must go, without companion, without advocate. You have already left what will cause others to tremble. By entering religion, you have shown that you despise earthly joys. You must also willingly leave in heart and in mind the few things of which you have still the use or enjoyment. Detach yourselves from all things now, before death violently and irrevocably tears them from you. Your cell will soon be occupied by another, your books made over to another, your office filled by another. You must enter the house of your eternity, which it is still in your power to render a happy home. The care of your sisters, the skill of your physician, may delay death's approach for a while, but a time will come when you will be extended on your poor bed, feeling as you never felt before, cold perspiration and beads on your forehead, the pallor of death on your countenance, your heart breaking. An hour or less, and you have done with the world. It has come to an end for you. Friends, relatives, sisters, the pupils you taught, the sick you visited, the afflicted you consoled, all have now become to you as if they never were. Things bright and beautiful, the glorious heavens, the sunny scenes on which you love to gaze, the glassy ocean, the blue sky, the gorgeous taints of nature's loveliness, have all gone, so far as you are concerned. Your eyes are closed on them forever. Your ears are shut to all that could charm them. The world for you has ceased to exist. Others will come after us. The works of mercy will be performed as well or better without us. The convent will be filled with new hands to do God's work, and few will remember that we ever existed. At the end of the music, this recording will be continued on Side B.